This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
an RPG syllabus.
Welsh Patagonians.
Elliot Davis.
And Walter Russell.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. But in the gaming hut, we're told to stop crunching those Doritos and thumping those miniatures. Pay attention. We're in class. We're in college class. We're in RPG Design 101. And the question is, what is on the curriculum? And I assume that you have ideas, much as I do, Robin. And I think we were talking previously about one of the problems with this art form is it is not yet big and successful enough to have a standard modal curriculum. And I guess we're fixing that problem now.
Well, weirdly, it's already happening, but it's happening in little sprouts and appearances. And so there are courses now. Sometimes they're courses that people in other departments have turned into their role-playing design courses because they're interested in role-playing and see all sorts of applications for them. But I know that now there are a number of RPG design courses, but they're not springing up in sort of a process way. And I don't know how much context they have in terms of the professional side of the business, because the business until now has been very small. The number of people in it has been quite small. And we haven't yet quite gotten to the point where people move from running role-playing companies to being professors at universities. We may be in a situation where there aren't going to be universities anymore, but that's a different...
That's a different
that's
argument.
A different hut
and of course, Dave Arneson of blessed memory taught role-playing game design at Full Sail University for many years. So this is not necessarily a new thing, but it is the sort of everybody reinvents the wheel every time they do it.
Right. So if we were called on to reinvent the wheel, my bias as someone who works in it professionally and has to answer such questions as what order should this traditional role-playing book be in? Or even, you know, how should this story game be best configured to convey the experience the designer wants to convey? makes me think that we want to do something fairly systematic and not necessarily just, oh, here's a thing that you can play around with, and you at the end of the course, you can have something that you put up on itch, but talk about how a role-playing game is produced and what skills are necessary to produce it, the same way that all sorts of different gigantic courses with lots of students all around the world teach for video games. So I think that I would start with the layout of a given trad game in terms of, not as layout, but a structure, and why it is in that order. Look at all the different components, and then from there, slide backwards into a history of the form. Because a completely different course would be analyzing role-playing games as critically, the way that you would literature or jazz or whatever other form of art. And that would certainly start historically with Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax and Dave McGarry and the precursors of role-playing and the roots of it and all the different directions that they've gone in. We've talked about that a lot on the show, but I think from a practical perspective, I would say look at a book that's acknowledged to be a good trad book that people use and use well, and analyze why is it in that order, and then look at another book that breaks the mold, and it's like, okay, why is this book in this order? And then from there, look at all the sort of practical components and then build back into, you know, now we have our character generation design portion. Here we have the crunchy bits design. Here we have setting design, and begin to break all of those down into the processes that we use to produce them, which will, I think, require some analysis in a lot of cases of things that we just sort of do instinctively based on what other people have done, and start to find some working theories behind all of the practice that we've been engaged in without developing theories.
So this is not an art history class. This is an art class.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, starting with structure is certainly, I mean, you're going to need structure in there. I don't have an objection to starting with it. I think that it is actually going to be kind of useful to inculcate a habit of presenting as much gameable information in as compact a space as you can. So some sort of writing exercise, I think, is going to have to be in there. Technical writing, it may be, but it is still writing. And notions sort of to get our burgeoning designers away from sort of the Dickensian paid by the word bloat of maybe the 90s era of RPGs, and move into what's going to be useful at the table. This will, you know, also, of course, be helpful when you're putting it up on itch or whatever, so you don't have to write 300 pages when 90 would do.
Yes. Yeah, so if you submit 300 pages, you get a C. If you submit 200 pages, you get a B. If you submit 100 pages and they're good, you get an A.
You get an A. Yeah. And then I think that there's definitely a role for, I think you mentioned it or alluded to it, mechanics. So there's building blocks of tabletop game design and encyclopedia of mechanisms. So you can take some of those. I think a lot of these are for board games, but you can take some of them and apply them to, as you say, the randomizer engine, the character generation system, how those two interplay. So just looking at mechanics, even if not divorced from their original source material, but you're not saying we're going to study Apocalypse World. We're going to study playbooks, and we're going to study roll a 10 or better on 2d6 as our resolution mechanic. And why is that different than roll a success on 3d6?
Yes. And get not only into the mathematics and statistics of that, but into the entertainment value that it fosters. How do I feel when I'm rolling a percentile die versus a bell curve? Not only what does that do mathematically, but how does it affect the feelings of the people playing it? Because as we said, this is about creating an art, and you're creating a tool for other people to create art. And so this essentially is not just about getting your math right, which, of course, games are still often published today with not just math that has a weird little bump in it, but things that just literally don't work at all, and how to make sure that the arithmetic of your game works, but also you know why you're picking it. And so I guess that's where we're starting to get into a bit of history, but I think sort of a practical history of here's this rule set versus this rule set. Here's how they do what they do, and here's how you feel when you're doing it, I think is an interesting thing that I would want a curriculum to emphasize.
And I think breaking them out into mechanical elements will go a ways away from, oh, we're just doing, you know, West End Star Wars. Oh, we're just doing Unknown Armies. Oh, we're just doing this. Take the Unknown Armies percentiles, compare those to the Call of Cthulhu percentiles, compare those to the other percentiles, and say, here are different ways we can use this engine to do different things. I think the game economy is going to be something we're going to need to address. You know, is it point dependent? Do you need to spend points to get things moving? And if so, where do those points come from? How do they refresh? How long do they stay on the scene? Every game has a question like that. And some games say, no, we're not spending points. It's just narrative momentum, which is oddly truest of the most trad and the most story game forward games. But you need to look at game economy. What keeps the game going? What creates a mechanical unbalance that is reflected in play? Or do you?
The next question is scenario design part of the 101 course or is it part of the 201 course? You could argue at the second case, which it's its own can of worms that's just as complicated as the other thing. The other argument, of course, would be you can't have one without the other. Mm-hmm. That the scenario is what you're moving toward, and that a lot of good scenario design is having played a lot and being able to predict what the median group of players is going to do at the table, what they're going to want to accomplish and what they're going to suggest their characters do, and be prepared for that. And so that also suggests that there has to be a big practical component of actually playing games and doing that a lot, because that's, you know, that's the equivalent of, you know, doing your woodshedding, of learning how to play your instrument in a practical jazz course is a lot of practical playing and looking at what happened at the table and not only how the rules mechanics reinforced what the group wanted to do or fought what the group wanted to do, but also how did the players fight the premises of the scenario, and how do you make sure that your scenario is largely premised in ways that accept what it is that the typical group of players is going to want to do.
I think the notion of practical play, not as something you do in class, but something you're expected to do outside class. And again, the classic example, as you say, is musical instrument training, where in class, the instructor tells you, this is how to do fingering. Then you go off and do it for 9 hours in a soundproof room somewhere. Same thing. We're telling you, this is how bell curves work. This is how character generation works. Now go off and do it in a soundproof room for 9 hours. Right. And that component maybe can be part of our missing honored in the breach RPG history, because what you can have them play in the same way that when you practice, you play standards, you play, you know, the set pieces for, you know, concert violin or jazz flute or whatever. You are playing Village of Hamlet. You're playing The Haunting. You're playing whatever the first adventure is in the Star Wars book. You're playing these classic adventures that so that there can be a body of response to them that you can usefully learn from, even if what you learn is no one should design an adventure like Village of Hamlet now.
An adventure in quotation marks.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so what I think you'd want to do in that, and it, yeah, I agree absolutely that the play occurs outside of class hours and your classwork is to bring a report on what happened in your game. Uh-huh. I think that you'd want to make sure initially that you picked classic things that actually work, which is possibly a short list. Yeah. Because when you go back and you're asked to revise a classic thing, you're often surprised by what's in it. And oh my, it's sometimes a wonder anyone likes this or that we have role playing at all based on what's in some early products. But I would want to start people off with a really great experience and then only move them backwards into, okay, play this set of encounters where you know that one of the encounters is really broken and something goes terribly wrong, and then say, well, what, you know, why did this go wrong? What would you do in a game design that's aware of the problem that this scenario typifies? And, you know, Village of Hamlet would definitely be exhibit A in what isn't really an adventure and what sort of completely off-model play that it will inspire if you run it as if it is an adventure. Well, I think we've talked about the beginnings of the curriculum a lot, and maybe later we can come back and ask what a RPG art history course would be? I think that's an easier question, which is why we'll leave it for later, perhaps right. when we're sleepy or tired. But now, since we're wide awake and alert, let's head into another hut and or site.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula Dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase.
It's time once more to stumble into the History Hut, but this time around it has some, the flags are different. I think there's like a red dragon and a white background, and there's a lot of unpronounceable words. I don't understand that anything is being said here, except I well understand the question posed to us by beloved patron backer Charles Picard, who says, is there an interesting gaming use for the Welsh-speaking communities of Patagonia? This, of course, would be a Wladva, which means the colony, or sometimes the Welsh colony, which is Ywadfa Grimrig. I can't even pronounce French. Do not expect me to pronounce Welsh. Ken, this is a very unusual example of cultural survival. I don't even know what to call this. This is just such an unusual idea and turn of events. So why don't you start the story?
Yeah, as a preface to the story, this is not the first attempt by Welsh to get as far away from the English as they possibly can. There was a Welsh colony in Newfoundland called Avalon that was established in 1610. That was destroyed by the French in 1696. William Penn suckered a bunch of Welsh Quakers into moving to Pennsylvania by promising them a Welsh tract. And when they got there, oh, I'm sorry, it's all full of English people. Too bad. In 1790, a different bunch of Welsh moved to a different place in Pennsylvania, Cambria County, and that began as a Welsh colony, but it wasn't really good land. This was before they started digging the coal, and so everyone moved to Ohio within the next 10 or 15 years. There is a similar Welsh colony established in the Utica, New York area in 1795. That eventually reached 4,000 people. Whole stretches of Oneida County, New York were Welsh-speaking up until the Civil War. So that may be the most successful Welsh colony until this one. There was a Welsh colony in Brazil, only had about 100 people in it. That ran from 1850 to 1872. Another Welsh colony was in Tennessee at Bryn Finnan, and that's from 1856 to 1872, so badly interrupted by the Civil War. And in 1872, they basically gave up on it, and it was replaced by a colony of English utopians, which renamed it Rugby Colony. So the more things change, the more they stay the same. So Michael D. Jones, a Welsh Congregationalist minister who had gone to the Promised Land of Ohio, comes back to Wales in 1850 to report that it seems like a great idea to move to America and get a farm or a coal mine, but you stop speaking Welsh and everyone will speak English around you. So we need to solve that problem of finding an entirely deserted land so that the Welsh can stay Welsh. And they considered Canada, they considered Australia, they considered Palestine briefly, which is a wild alternate history. So they, you know, looked around for various places. Apparently Vancouver, British Columbia was the place in Canada.
Yes, but it was rejected as being not remote enough.
Right.
Which was correct because it's now our third largest city. So
right, yeah.
they would have been de-Welshed in Vancouver.
De-Welshed rapidly.
They get some cool flip-flops though.
Right. And at the time there was a very real danger in 1850 that they might have accidentally become American again, which was the whole point of not doing that. But Argentina is looking for European settlers for Patagonia because Patagonia is a deserted, except for the Patagonians, land. They wanted a claim against Chile to be shored up by actual settlement as opposed to an abstract line on a map. And so they offered the Welsh homesteads along the Chubut River. And the Chubut River is about 850 miles south of Buenos Aires. So if you look at a map of Argentina, it's about not quite two-thirds of the way down Argentina. So a couple of Welsh fellows with, thank God, easy-to-pronounce names, Captain Love Jones Perry and Lewis Jones, came and explored the Chubut area in 1862, and they came back and said, good news, this is just like Wales. And 153 Welsh settlers arrive at the Chubut in 1865 and discover it's a waterless desolation. So I guess...
Oh, no. Jones, Perry, and Jones had their hands behind their backs and their fingers crossed about it being just like Wales.
Right. And maybe a handsome stipend from the Argentine government. Who can say? So the settlers said, this is terrible. We want to go live in the Falklands. And the British government said, we're too busy. We can't be dealing with that nonsense. So they have to sort of make the best of the Chubut Valley. There's a sort of a little pilgrimage from the mouth of the Chubut to where they eventually build Rawson, the capital of the Chubut colony. And then Rawson is carried away in a flood and there's drought and no one is a farmer. Everyone who came was not a farmer. So we're recapitulating Jamestown now, but they don't really have a choice. They're stuck there. So they make the best of it. The local Tehuelche Indians help them over the hump, you know, trade them meat for delicious bread. The settlers figure out irrigation canals. I don't feel like you can put Welsh anywhere without digging starting. So that was good.
Yes. The woman who thought, hey, we should irrigate. We know her name is Rachel Jenkins. So she
Rachel Jenkins
also helped save this colony.
A tough-minded foremother of the Welsh Patagonian colony of Iwladfa.
Right. Now, the original plan was for them to have full autonomy. But yeah. Guess what? A government bringing you there in order to establish a territorial claim against a rival doesn't actually mean that either. And so in 1881, they asserted direct rule over the colony. So some Welsh hopes were dashed there.
The colony was still self-governing. Everyone got a vote. It was very forward-thinking. And it stayed sort of a Argentine rule, but Welsh-governed colony for a while. But eventually the Argentines did try to introduce, you know, the draft and other stuff, and that caused ructions. But that was later on. They started building a railway to go from Rawson inland so they get to more farmland. By now, their grain is winning awards in various European and American markets. They're self-supporting. They can't afford the railway. They have to sort of let investors take care of that. But the British are always happy to build another railway in Argentina. So they build new settlements at the head of the Chubut River, and that is in the foothills of the Andes, and they start building those in 1888. So now we have a railway that runs up the Chubut River. The total emigration from Wales is not maybe what Michael Jones originally thought. It was about 2,300 people that emigrated between 1865 and 1911. Some also came from Pennsylvania, from the failed colonies there, and from Brazil, and from Tennessee. So you have little bits right. of them.
Now, if Michael D. Jones was disappointed that not enough people were going to Patagonia, a notable person who didn't go to Patagonia was Michael D. Jones, who went there only once for a brief visit in 1882. So perhaps this brings into question the excitement and viability of this colony, if even its founder had no intention of ever living there.
Yeah, at least William Penn walked the walk. So by 1900, the population of Chubut is about 4,000 Welsh. And you might think, wonderful. What a great situation. Everyone's happy.
That's sustainable. 4,000 people.
Yeah. After World War I, Italians flooded into the area and Welsh became a minority language after Spanish and Italian, which is, you know, at least it's not English. At least it makes a change. By now, according to Wikipedia, there are about 70,000 Welsh Patagonians or Welsh Argentine people living in Patagonia. and fewer than 5,000 of them actually speak Welsh. So in a way, the dream of a Wales overseas is truer than ever, because once more, barely anyone speaks Welsh and everyone is part of the larger country that they moved into. So there we are.
Right. And in 1997, the British Council founded a funding program to preserve Welsh language and culture in this community. So you've got an additional irony there that now this culture needs preservation with British lottery money. So the whole question of let's preserve our dwindling culture by going somewhere which is as beautiful and verdant as Wales, but nobody lives in, when looked at that way, seems to have a logical flaw. So obviously, since we've been tasked with finding the gaming application of this, we have to ask ourselves what was really going on, since what we know went on makes no sense.
Since it's a clearly dumb plan.
Yeah. And not even the guy who thought it up wanted to live there. So obviously there was an item that would have been taken there by the settlers for protection. So it wasn't about, it was sort of about moving Welsh people away from England, but it was even more so about moving an artifact away from England where it could not be taken and used for the wrong purposes. So what great mythic Welsh item would that have been? Well, we know, first of all, it can't be the Cauldron of Dagda, because that cauldron produced abundant food. And anyway, is Irish, so that's two strikes against it.
It's not going to work.
Yeah, if it produced abundant food, the whole system would have worked. So maybe the Irish should have done this. Obviously, we know that it's not the ancient yew tree in Llangurnu, which contains the spirit or angel or devil named Angelistor, because you can't uproot a yew tree. Perhaps they took a branch or something, or some seeds, but that doesn't keep that entity away from the English, so that doesn't seem as effective or likely. So surely what they were hiding, taking with them, was Ceridwen's Cauldron of Inspiration, which she used to make her ugly son a bard. So to take someone who was unqualified to do the job and make everyone think, through inspiration, that the improbable was in fact probable. And what more of a device would you need to have any Welsh people still speaking Welsh today other than the Cauldron of Inspiration? So clearly then, when the player characters need a Cauldron of Inspiration, something that's even better than the internet at making the improbable seem probable, you are going to have to go to Welsh Patagonia in order to find exactly where it is hidden and either convince them to loan it to you, and good luck with that if you don't speak Welsh, or perhaps, let's just say, borrow it for a little while, or perhaps you are a Welsh Patagonian in a one-shot trying to protect the Cauldron of Inspiration, because what if modern specialists in disinformation get a hold of it? Well, things will go even worse than they currently are. So I think that is definitely the gaming scenario that comes out of this, is revolving around the Cauldron of Inspiration.
We can also speculate that possibly the body of King Arthur is in Argentina. And hear me out, Robin. We have a colony of Avalon in Newfoundland, right? They bring King Arthur over from the island of Avalon in Wales, which is full of English people now. They take him to Newfoundland, settle him there. The French come in, but by then, they've moved to the Welsh tract in Pennsylvania. They bounce it around North America for a while. It's in Oneida County. That explains the burned over district, Robin. Arthur's puissant power causes cults and magic to spring up from the ground. They move it out of Oneida County into Brazil. And from Brazil, they move it down into Argentina. And that is where King Arthur is waiting. And we're just probably fortunate that during the Falklands unpleasantness, the Argentine military dictatorship did not learn that King Arthur slumbers somewhere in the Chubut Valley in Patagonia.
Well, that certainly gives a way for Arthur to come back, as is his wont. So between the cauldron and the king who will return, there's plenty of stuff to come out of Welsh Patagonia. But the next thing that is going to come out of this podcast is another Hut and Or segment. caught in the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Keep this podcast syllabus updated by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Ben A.
Dave Stecco.
Jacob Boersma.
Michael Dowman.
And Tequila.
It's time once more for Ken and or Robin talk with someone else. And today, the someone else we're talking to is Elliot Davis, a.k.a. the best username on the internet, More Blueberries. Is there a program behind which Americans can rally? No. That's the one.
That's the one.
More Blueberries. Elliot, thanks for coming on the program. Thanks for joining the podcast.
Yeah,
congratulations on the Emerging Designer Award. That's
thank
terrific.
You.
You've got a lot of projects, sort of. You've not got a single sort of main thing that you're focused on. Some people, it's like you're that one game and
right.
other stuff, but you've got a sort of a broad hand of games. And then most recently, you've been doing a lot of solo game,
mm-hmm.
solo adventure design.
Yep.
Before we get to the solo stuff, which I know is very hot right now and everyone's excited about it, I want to talk about Rom-Com Drama Bomb.
Oh,
because there are so few games about romance. Mm-hmm. Of course, Emily Carabas, peace be unto her, pioneered the genre mm-hmm. a mere 40 years after the art form was invented. Do you see Rom-Com Drama Bomb as in conversation with things like Breaking the Ice and Shooting the Moon, or are we finally at a point where you can create without having to be in dialogue with the first people to do it? Are we
sure.
far enough along in designing romantic RPGs that, like, I can write a stabbing rule without going back to Dave Arneson, but
right.
Where do you see yourself in the panoply of romance game designers?
Yeah, I think that in terms of romance games, the big inspiration for me was Star-Crossed by Alex Roberts.
Right, yes.
Which is
Titan of the field.
Titan of the field, and just that like really tight focus story using mm-hmm. the Jenga tower was interesting. And then the game also takes a lot of DNA from Yuzeba's Bed and Breakfast, which is a J-Dragon
right,
design,
yeah.
And the Belonging Outside Belonging system more mm-hmm. broadly. And on a mechanical level, is just like, what if Belonging Outside Belonging had a timer and was like kind of, you were min-maxing Belonging Outside Belonging a little bit.
Right.
But yeah, in terms of romance, Star-Crossed was the biggest influence. And then also, I am just a rom-com head.
Right, yeah, exactly.
My whole life, like, family loved rom-coms, and I'm always excited about new rom-coms and the like.
And it's got to be a little frustrating. I mean, when I did Nice Black Agents, it's Spies and Vampires, both of which were very hot in 2016 when I did it,
mm-hmm.
Or whenever I did it. Let's say it was 2016. And then rom-coms have been sort of, you know, present in absentia in the last decade or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the 90s anymore, certainly. Do you think that gives you more creative freedom? Are you worried that you're writing games for people who don't know the genre because they've grown up on nothing but people being sad at each other for 95 episodes on Netflix?
I did have a little bit of an experience when I started taking this to game stores where a lot of the things that I consider like dead on touchstones of the genre, you know, When Harry Met Sally and like My Big Fat Greek Wedding and like 10 Things I Hate About You, there were people who would be like, oh, I haven't seen that. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense to me.
Haven't read Shakespeare?
Right. Exactly. In terms of rom-coms, these are the Shakespeares of that genre. And so it's, you're right. Like we've been in a bit of a lull of rom-coms. There's been a handful in the last like five or so years, but it is sort of also because of the premise of the game being like a villain forcing two people to make the perfect rom-com, it's a little bit of a self-insert of, I want people to make more rom-coms. Right.
It's both meta and also almost a utopian fiction.
Exactly. Because the joy is then I get to see, like, when I host events where I set, like, you know, four or five tables up, I get to go around and hear about these trope-filled rom-coms that people have made up at the table that are, like, that have that flavor and DNA of the movies I love that inspired the game, but are also now like their whole original story.
Right. And that's sort of one of the great things about the art form in general is you are not stealing, not even swiping, but you are taking inspiration from best of other art forms and then turning it into something that can only be done at the table and only be done interactively with people, mm-hmm. which brings me to the question of, why would anyone make a solo role-playing game? What's the purpose of that? The whole point of this art form is to be with other people and do stuff.
Totally.
You know what I call a solo role-playing game? A novel.
Yeah.
And that's fair. I mean, obviously I'm being ridiculous for the purpose of a podcast, my life for the last decade, but isn't there some sort of part of you that as an artist is asking yourself, what am I even doing with this?
Sure.
I mean, artistically, I know that people love it, mm-hmm. and time and everything else and whatever else. Blah, 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 but make the Steel Man case for the solo adventure, the solo RPG.
Yeah, right? I think that I'll give two strong cases for solo play in RPGs. One is, I think that, you know, the pandemic in the last, like, 5 years, like, people are lonelier than ever. Mm-hmm. I think that there's, like, a difficulty people are having in, like, socializing and making friends and stuff. And while, you know, there's an argument to be made of, like, don't encourage that, encourage people to get into groups. Like, some people, like, isolated. I think that the big population boom was the pandemic. I think it was, I'm at home, I want to play these games, maybe I don't like online play, how can I engage in this idea of role play, of storytelling? And it's almost solo role playing isn't quite accurate. It, like, a lot of, you know, the phrasing that comes up is like a solo journaling game. And I think that what I feel like solo play is when it's best is that they're playing with me as the designer. Like, mm-hmm. I'm setting up the half of play that another person would occupy at the table with them. And that is, like, done by, like, designing a little more heavily than maybe you would for a scenario that is GM-led and, like, has input from, like, four or five people. It's, like, it's a conversation between me and them at its best. And then I think that when it comes to solo adventures and solo supplements for other games, I think that the Steel Man for that is, like, it is a way of, I want to play this system with a group. How can I get comfortable with it before doing that? And I think that, especially with the work I've done with Soul Muppet, that's the one of the main drivers is, like, how can we give people a overarching taste of the system so that they're really, they have gotten the experience of, this is what it feels like to tell an Orbital Blues story.
Right.
I now have done that alone, so now I have the context and I have the confidence to then go to my D&D group and be like, hey, I played this whole game and here's the story I told. Don't you guys want to tell a story like that?
Right. And that, I think, is an interesting approach to the question. The notion of not just, I want to have a Cthulhu adventure.
Right.
But I want to be able to present this kind of adventure for other people and to interact with them, and I want to have that confidence with it. Is that something that you think in your own play, have you done that? Is that a thing that you've done to learn a system? Do you, now when you sit down with a new book, are you mentally playing a solo adventure with it? Or is this still, you know, something that you, because you grew up before the pandemic,
right,
you're already socialized and you don't need to have that mental practice?
I think that, like, on the personal level of trying new systems, I've been really fortunate to have a great home group that was always, like, game to try new systems, mm-hmm. and so, like, even if, like, I never had that, like, fear of fumbling through a new system with my group, so I always felt comfortable. But there's a few different kind of interesting conversations that happen, and some of them are headier in a way that I don't know that I am always on board with. But one of the things people talk about is that reading RPGs is a kind of solo play, because while you're reading it, you're imagining the scenarios, you're imagining play.
It's closet drama in the old sense of the term.
Exactly. And then the other idea of something that is kind of what I pretty strongly consider solo play, but has never been talked about, that is, I think traditional GM prep is a kind of solo play. I think that, like, when you're running a long-form D&D campaign and you're writing the villain monologues and you're creating the scenarios, like, you're doing solo play.
When you're
like,
randomizing the dungeon.
When you're randomizing the dungeon, 100%. Yeah. So I think it's a lineage from there. Like, I think it's, like, it's not as much of a departure from the hobby as maybe it seems at first glance, because of those things that, like, a lot of us are already doing, like reading games and getting excited about them and prepping games as well.
Let me real fast ask, what do you consider to be best practices for a solo adventure or a solo RPG? And I feel personally that journaling is, like you say, it's a big part of how solo games are presented.
Yep.
But it's almost a different sort of a thing.
Yeah.
If you're doing not a journaling game, but a more straightforward solo adventure,
yeah,
what do you think are the maybe the pitfalls that you always try to avoid, or the things you always try to hit? If there's a weird and messed up mechanic, do you hit it head on? Mm-hmm. Do you sort of present the best case for it? What's your approach when you're taking a game maybe that you didn't design and doing a solo for it?
Yeah, definitely. I think that one of the big things with I think the pitfall of trying to design solo play in an existing system is that you're never going to be able to make a broad experience to the degree that the game offers. Like, you know, like I did Paint the Town Red. I did The Morning After, which is a solo Muppet game. Paint the Town Red, Morning After is the solo supplement. And that solo supplement gets specific. And I think that that is kind of the key thing about when you take solo play out of a broad game. You want to take a specific look at a kind of play in it while bringing as much of the base game in as possible. I think that I always, when it's meant to be an introduction to a game or like help a GM prep for a game, is how can I get as much of what makes this game special into the pieces of this game while it feels like its own experience. So making sure we're using the core dice mechanic or the core mechanic of the game, make sure that's an active part of play. You know, whether the game introduces something like playing cards or something else, which playing cards is often my go-to for mm-hmm. introduction because it's a great randomizer for an individual person. So I think, like, kind of when in doubt with solo games, playing cards and tarot cards are two fantastic randomizers.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the pitfall can be when you try to say, like, how do I tell a story that is as big in scope as what they're going to get at the table with a group? You want to get the small character-focused scope. And that's what it often is. Like, a solo play is a character-focused game. Even if the game, what makes it special, is a world, it's like solo is always going to be about character. That's where it's going to be the most interesting, because that's where the player can take themselves and insert themselves into it. And then additionally, I always like to find a way to give it some table presence, like, because I think that that can be kind of, that can be an aid for immersion when you're by yourself. Obviously, when you sit down around a table with people, you have that table feel, the magic circle. Mm-hmm. Like, how can you create that feeling by yourself? I like to have a lot of bits and bobs, like index cards over here for one thing, you know, a deck of cards over here, a little notebook to take notes as you play, and your dice and your character sheets. You have this sort of tableau that you're playing with, and you can really dive into the game.
Yeah, the whole structure of it is a crazy design challenge.
Yeah.
It, you know, you're doing regular gaming, like you say, you have to focus on one character, and you don't have, even in one-to-one, which is one GM, one player, it's hard to do it because you're used to leaning on the other players to do things, both as the GM and as a player,
right.
And it becomes more intense. Do you think that if you're playing a solo game, you, the designer, do you want that person to just get more and more tense and involved and invested and driven? Mm-hmm. Or do you want them to say, whoa, this is a little bit like when you're watching a scary movie and you, I have to check my phone, I can't keep doing this.
Mm-hmm.
What's your desired state in a solo player?
Yeah, I think, like, you know, obviously players will do whatever they want, but right. if I've done my job right, they can't help but sit and pull the next card and answer the next prompt and get to that kind of, like, conclusion. That's, right. I think, solo play at its best. Like, there's a design school for solo play that is very contemplative and meditative, and I think that's great. Like, there's a lot of games that work really well in that. But specifically when I'm trying to match the energy of a game that is normally a table of people, I want it to have tension. I want it to have, like, a clear goal that you just want to hit and hit and hit. And so in the Wanderer, which is the Orbital Blues solo game, that's making a poker hand. And so you have that sort of clear goal in mind with every card. You're like, oh, well, this is like another ace, so maybe I start working towards a flush, and you get that gamey,
right,
like true gamey exactly. feel that keeps you in it. And then also, you know, the story should keep hooking you as you go. So I would love someone to just get wrapped up and sit down and, you know, spend 4 or 5 hours like on it, which is maybe a little much.
But yeah, it's a very interesting sort of flow state to try and build in one person.
It is, yeah.
Without, you know, chaining them to a radiator. Talk about your own sort of journey to this point. Obviously, you said you've got a great game group that loves to play other games. You're in literally the catbird seat as far as people who play. And also, I think a lot of designers wind up with groups that are willing to play with other kind of systems.
Yeah.
So you're exposed to it more. What flipped your switch from, I just love playing and GMing, to I want to write, I want to design? How did you get here to this very chair in this very hotel room?
So it was, I really got into tabletop in the pandemic. That was like kind of my deep dive into first D&D, and then in 2021 discovering the wider world of other systems, and Blades in the Dark was one of the first non-D&D I tried, and then just kind of opened up from there. And what I discovered was through like my local gaming store, 20 Side Store in Brooklyn, which is a fantastic store, like zine games and the small press publishing world
sort
of games.
The itch community.
The itch community, TTRPG Twitter at the time, which was a much better place and doesn't really exist anymore. Yeah. We're all on Blue Sky now. And I saw some people talking about Zine Month 2022, formerly Zine Quest on Kickstarter, but Kickstarter dropped Zine Quest that year, and a kind of community of the zine creators and itch creators were like, let's do our own month. You can like make a zine game kind of anywhere. And I like saw the whisperings of it, and I just was like, I'm gonna give it a shot. I had a game idea, which was my first game, Abominations, which is a very board gamey little zine that is, you use Scrabble tiles to make mad science monsters, and then you battle them out. It's like a D10 roll off, and I just gobbled up all the resources that the community put out there. Tony Vicinda of +1EXP put out like a press kit making video, and I made a press kit for this zine that I'd never made a game before, and I did pre-orders for the zine on Itch and sold like 10 and printed 50, and then I sold 10 to the local gaming store, which was like this huge vote of confidence and validation for me of like, oh, I can like sell a game for money. And that just kind of was like the thing that made me believe in it. And then I made
some
another.
Some of them spent decades never having that validation.
So. I tell the owner of the gaming store, who's a friend now, that like them taking that chance on me was the difference between like, oh, this is just a hobby, and like, oh, maybe there's a little twinkle that this could be a career someday. And I did it on the side for 2 years. I made gradually bigger games until I made my first little digest book game, Project Echo, which was a solo game. And then last January, I went full-time in games.
Fantastic.
And so I've been doing that for about a year and a half.
And your storefront is on Itch? Do you have a store?
I have a storefront on Itch. I have a web store where I sell physical, and then I'm in distribution through
Studio. Is that moreblueberries.com? And if it's not, why not?
Website's moreblueberries.com. Store is moreblueberries.shop.
Okay,
and they're
fantastic.
Both interlinked.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay, if people want to follow you, you said that, are you on Blue Sky? Are you somewhere?
I'm on Blue Sky, Instagram. TikTok, but I haven't posted in a bit, and it's More Blueberries on all of those.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming out. Thank you for spreading the More Blueberries gospel and for doing your best at the heresy of solo role-playing games, a contradiction in terms, which you're selling not just everyone, but maybe even me on. So thanks a lot. Great to have you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. This was a delight.
The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
It's time once again to wend our way up the creakety cobweb stairs. We're going to pause on the landing to wave to the portrait of the King of the Fire Salamanders. He's going to wink and wave back. That's just the kind of fire elemental he is. And then we're going to head on in to the parlor of the consulting occultist, who has been summoned in this instance by beloved Patreon backer Michael Monoval, who wants to know about artist and scientist Walter Russell. If you start researching Walter Russell, you find many different Walter Russells over history, including people who have Russell as their middle name, confusing the search terms altogether. But Ken, you managed to dive through the disambiguation to unveil the story of Walter Russell.
Yeah, the Walter Russell you want is Walter Bowman Russell, born May 19th, 1871 in Boston. He, Robin, you'll be glad to know he's Canadian by blood. His folks came to Boston from Nova Scotia, so you own at least half of everything that's about to happen.
Oh, he's a Maritimer. That explains a lot.
Anyway, he's a musical prodigy as a child, has perfect pitch, can play the piano, sight read, etc. And in May of 1878, when he is seven, he has his first sense of cosmic consciousness and an out-of-body experience. And every May, right around his birthday, becomes a new mystical moment for him thereafter. And did he go tell his parents then? Of course not. He knew better than that. He kept it to himself and only told the universe much, much later. But right around then, he does drop out of school because the family doesn't have enough money. So he goes and he works first as a dry goods clerk, then works as an organist in churches and theaters and halls. He becomes a professional musician and music teacher as a young lad. And then basically with the money he's made, puts himself into art school, and he attends the Massachusetts Normal Art School in Boston from 1884 to 1889. And this is when he is still, you know, very young. So he's like 12 when he starts art school. And again, May of 1885, people have been waiting to see what will happen. And this is when he dies of black diphtheria, Robin. And that's the end. We're done. Segment's over.
That sounds like the even worse diphtheria.
Yeah. But no, fortunately, even as a lad of 14, he understands cosmic illumination and the principle of self-healing. And he's able to magic himself back to life. And once more, Robin, he doesn't commit anything so easily checked as tell anyone at this time.
It is convenient that he got the black diphtheria in May right at the same time that he gets his annual mystical experience.
Yeah, that's a real break for him. If he'd gotten it in June, I assume that would be all. But anyway, he then goes to the Academie Julienne in Paris. It looks like the years are 1893 and 1894, so he just missed Chambers, but he's not so well documented.
That's Robert W. Chambers of the King in Yellow fame.
Right, yeah. But he's not so well documented, you can't pretend. So if you want Robert W. Chambers to meet a weird diphtheriac musical prodigy in your game or whatever, have at it. In that period, he also marries his first wife, Helen. This is between tours at the Academie Julienne. At some point, he studies under Howard Pyle at Drexel in Philadelphia, because he later says Howard Pyle, beloved artist of Robin Hood and King Arthur, was one of his artistic mentors. And so Pyle doesn't start teaching in Philadelphia until 1894. So I assume that somewhere his timeline has been massaged by his later pupils. In 1895, this again, according to the USP website, which is the website of his University of Science and Philosophy that he sets up much later, he assumes the directorship of the Twilight Club, which is the American branch of an Illuminati established by the freethinker Herbert Spencer. And it's very exciting. There's a whole list of members of the Twilight Club. Mark Twain is in it. All manner of great people. And I got very excited.
That's like the name of a role-playing game right there.
Right.
That's just waiting for us to pick it up.
The Twilight Club, 1895. Yep. And I got very excited, and I went to the perhaps mistaken length of looking up the Twilight Club. But the Twilight Club actually was a standard dining society, and it was established in honor of a visit to the U.S. by Herbert Spencer. So it was a bunch of notables that got together to throw Herbert Spencer a big dinner, had so much fun that they said, we should do this all the time, and they'd have people in to give talks on various subjects.
Or so the veil out says.
Or so the veil out
was suggest. So the cover story goes.
And in 1895, when he is 22, he probably maybe becomes a member of the actual Twilight Club, does not assume its secret directorate, unless, dun dun dun, as we say. So 1897 to 1898, he's the art editor of Collier's Magazine. He goes to Cuba to cover the war for Collier's. And then when he returns, he sets up as a painter in New York City and has great success. His painting, The Might of Ages, from 1900, which I looked at and said, this is an embarrassment to American art, was the official U.S. entry at the Turin Exposition, made a giant sensation, and he was hired to paint Teddy Roosevelt's children along other children of the scions of New York society. And so he's got it made. He's, joining the Twilight Club was the right thing to do for his career, certainly. He publishes three children's books between 1900 and 1904, and then he becomes a real estate developer, the great dream of all true artists. Basically, he's been hanging out with enough artists, and they've all been complaining about the rent enough that he says, what if there was a building we all owned together? And so he tries pitching a bunch of those.
So this is not at all the form of real estate development where you wear a mask and pose as a ghost and scare people away. This is beneficial.
Well, you could argue that. He gets a architectural firm that he's particularly fond of called Hard and Short. That's their real names. I did not make that up. Hard and Short, I think, are most famous and beloved to us, Robin, because all of their architecture somewhere on it had a salamander in the terracotta decoration. Then it was explained as the royal salamander of the King Henry II or maybe Francis I or some other royal salamander. We don't maybe want to nail it down.
The fire salamander is winking really hard on his painting.
Exactly. So the buildings that the Hard and Short build in this co-op wave include the Alwyn building. In that specific building, Russell drops out because he's bankrupt, so he can't keep his ownership. Another building, the Manhattan Square Apartments, which he does stay in long enough to sell all of his interest in immediately, and the Hotel des Artistes, 1914, completed 1917. So this is between 1907 and 1917. There's this period where he is really getting into real estate development. And I did run into a line where after World War I, he attempted to get state financing or city financing to just expand Manhattan by 6 blocks, just build it out into the river. And then he would coincidentally own that land and could build on it. But the city said, we're using the river, stop it. And so that was it. At some point, he moves into a studio above Carnegie Hall, and he moves his wife and daughters into a house in Westwood, Connecticut. And we cannot say that this is for any sort of bad intention. Lots of people kept city houses and country houses, but we're just going to say he's up to something. Anyway, while he's in Carnegie Hall, he may have been neighbors with Evangeline Adams, who is in Carnegie Hall from 1905 to 1932, beloved popular astrologer, and she is from episode 604, if you want to look at doing a crossover there. His other interests include ice skating. He founds the New York Skating Club in 1916.
So he's a true Renaissance man, which explains why his museum bills him as the Leonardo da Vinci
right.
of America.
Yeah, he's got a lot going on.
He's into skating and painting and mystical experiences.
Right. And he's also into making friends with rich people. And sure enough, Thomas J. Watson, the president of IBM, is his buddy. And together they found the Society of Arts and Sciences, which exists to give medals to artists that Walter Russell likes. And so that's good fun. That runs for about a decade until the money for medals has to go somewhere else. In May of 1921, he has a 39-day and night period of illumination. And this is where he sort of realizes the structure of the universe, that the universe is thought and will before it is matter. The thought and will that is light is God, and that elements are not different substances, as he says, but differently conditioned pressures of motion, which is sort of a, if you want to be generous, you could say it's sort of, you know, radical wave particleism, I guess, radical quantum theory. If you want to be ungenerous, it's crank new thought. And the structure of the atom, by the way, is based on the gyroscope, which I guess is why atoms all stay upright. I don't know. That seems weird.
Well, they do have things circling around other things. That's not the wrongest mystical insight you can have.
In 1926, he publishes this insight as the Universal One and patents a spiral-shaped periodic table. He has begun writing fun letters, let's say, to area scientists and to Columbia University and other people at this time. He's friends with Thomas Watson, so they can't tell him take a long walk off a short pier into your non-existent stretch of Manhattan. But their letters, I presume, are the sort of, gosh, that's an interesting thought. Thanks, Walter Bowman Russell.
Yes, and let's just put that in the crank pile.
Right. In 1926, he turns to sculpture from painting and real estate development and ice skating and public speaking and everything else and music. He's sculpting busts, eventually gets the commission for the Mark Twain Memorial in 1934, maybe through his Twilight Club connections, although the Twilight Club officially goes away around 1904. And the Four Freedoms Monument in 1943, which sounds impressive until you realize that it was always meant basically as a war bond thing. And they used it to raise money. And then they put it in the in Madison, Florida, in the hometown of a war hero, where I'm sure in Madison, Florida, they love it. But it's not like he put something on the Capitol Mall.
There is some indication that his bust making was lucrative.
Yeah.
For he would advertise in like scientific and educational journals, for example, his much reproduced bust of Thomas Edison.
Yeah, that was one of the first he did.
And so schools could buy the bust of Thomas Edison, display it in their school to inspire the students. And that does seem to have been a good angle of business for him.
Well, that's where the money is in busts, Robin, is school busts.
Yeah.
In 1927, speaking of where the money is, Thomas J. Watson hires him to give inspirational lectures to IBM scientists and employees. And that runs until 1939. I don't know if he gives a lecture like, don't supply the Nazis with punch cards. That may not have been a topic of one of his lectures, but there we are. We don't know. In 1930, he writes the Russell radiogenerative concept, which I just think maybe the best title that he uses. Sounds like a band that would open for Hawkwind, I think. Then in 1947, he publishes The Secret of Light. And in 1948, he divorces his estranged wife, Helen, to marry a disciple of his, Daisy Stebbing, who is 33 years his junior. He's 77 by now. And she changes her name to Lao, as in Lao Tzu. And so she has read The Secret of Light and said, this is the man for me, and sort of home-wrecked a home that was probably already tottering.
Yeah, there are pictures of them together on the site of his foundation, and they look like quite the glamorous power couple.
Right. They get married in Reno, Nevada because of the divorce, and then drive across country, and they find a old plantation built by an industrialist, not an old slave plantation, at Swannanoa in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and they buy it and turn it into the Home Study University of Science and Philosophy. So you write away for the curriculum and the courses, and you study at home, and then you take your tests and send them back in, and eventually you get graduated from the University of Science and Philosophy, and you get a cool diploma that you can keep at home and maybe 5% off on your Thomas Edison bust. I don't know.
Right. You can tell everybody about the spiral periodic table that the man is keeping you from understanding.
Exactly. In 1949, he takes a second run at writing his sort of thesis statement. This is where he tells the story of his illumination. It's in a 2-volume work called The Divine Iliad. 1953, A New Concept of the Universe. Once more, still trying to refine things. Basically, as atomic science has become bigger, he's sort of piggybacking on that. But he's worried about nuclear bombs, Robin, because in 1957, he writes Atomic Suicide? And this, once more, we are in danger, Robin, of just doing the same standard occultist, writes a bunch of nonsense, finally dies. But fortunately, we have the USP website, which informs us that in 1959, he meets with top brass from Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs to demonstrate his zero-point energy generator, which is two male and female magnetic coils that will generate energy between gravity and radiation. And so, obviously, Robin, such a device must have immediately been snapped up by the burgeoning NORAD and never heard of again. In May of 1963, speaking of things that happen in May, he dies on his 92nd birthday, and he is referred to as a 20th century Da Vinci in obituaries by Walter Cronkite, the New York Herald Tribune, and other people who I presume should have known better.
Well, they must have gotten awards from him in the past. Something had to happen there.
I assume so.
Maybe they were members of the Twilight Club. We don't know.
Yeah. Walter Cronkite, classic Twilight Club profile.
Right. And so his story is still kind of continuing because in 2019, the University of Science and Philosophy relocated, set up a museum dedicated to his art and philosophy in Waynesboro, Virginia, in a former Porsche dealership. And they use that Leonardo da Vinci quote, of course, in their publicity. So you can go there, you can book a tour, you can rent out the conference room. So there are obviously still people who are devoted enough to this illuminated philosophy.
And he has a lovely website where you can buy all of those books that I mentioned and more, maybe even a bust of Edison. I didn't look, actually. But
so I think probably the most promising use for him is in like a 50s atomic age weird science game where his zero-point energy generator actually works, but it only works around certain people. Mm-hmm. And you are those certain people, and you can draw on it for your weird science, either to power your machinery or make your own improbable devices work, right? Your perpetual motion machine works for a while if you've been around the zero-point energy generator. Your ray guns recharge when you use it, and it basically creates an improbability field, which can only be used by people who understand the gyroscopic nature of the atom, and then you can go around fighting giant ants and science supervillains.
Right, yeah, and that can, you know, explain why you have a flying car and no one else in the 1950s has a flying car, because that's where you put the generator, and that's how it works.
Right, and I think that gives you your balance of him presenting himself as a man of science and also a mystical illuminate at the same time. That gives you those two things together in one package.
Well, if you're fighting the 50s monsters, the horrors of the suicide of the atom, you can also be meeting the Nordic aliens who are full of mystical bourgeois. And you, because you are Russell scholars, you recognize their mystical bourgeois as perhaps kindred, or maybe, Robin, as elements of black diphtheria, and that they contain poisonous knowledge that Earth should not know.
Right. Or perhaps you could bring in the Shaver mystery and have Darrow's be generating black diphtheria energy.
And this is all leaving behind the wonders of the secret Illuminati Twilight Club, where you and Robert W. Chambers team up to fight art monsters in the 1890s. But who would make a game like that, Robin? That'd be crazy.
I can't imagine who would have the power to make games like that. Well, on that note, I think it's time for us to congratulate ourselves on the completion of yet another podcast episode and promise that there'll be yet another podcast episode a week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pellegrin Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Dissuade this podcast from moving to Patagonia by chipping in with such backers as
David Flisk.
Josh Street.
Nate Merritt.
Urs Blumentritt.
And Brian Orban.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design, 3i Atlas. It's a really fun space rock.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindelaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.